It's the Cost of Casinos edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Molly and the Assault in History, The Repopulator, Shriek of the Bigfoot, and The Cost of Casinos. Let's begin episode 198.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. Ethan, you must be really excited. You're like one of these sportsy people, right?
Sportsy people, yes, sure.
And if I don't know much about sports. I know that people get hurt and they do gambling and stuff like that. But isn't there some big event coming up this weekend? Are you excited about it?
Event this weekend. Are you referring to perhaps the World Championship curling event?
No, actually, and I'm going to laugh hysterically, because for a second there I thought you might not know what I was talking about, which I think is hilarious, because only someone who doesn't know anything about sports would think someone who is into sports is that. No, it's not curling, and they're playing hockey again, but I imagine hockey's not that big thing. In fact, I think it is isn't it, what do they call it in Europe, soccer? No, we call it soccer here, but they call it...
Rugby?
Football.
Oh. Football?
American-style football.
Super Bowl. Oh, I see. Right, yes. Well, that's kind of just a farm league for the CFL, isn't it?
It is. Well, you know, the Americans never could quite play it properly.
No.
So they had to shorten the field, and they have to give themselves an extra down just because they weren't, you know, Canadian man enough, no sexism involved there, to play the game properly. I don't even know who's playing. Do you know who's playing?
No, I only follow like big leagues, really. I'm so anti NFL. It's funny.
Well, you know, it's no, I got no good segue, so screw it.
Yeah.
Mally Malady. Yes, I like it when wordplay plays into this. As a number of our listeners may have heard, Harper is sending military transport planes to Timbuktu. And no, I don't mean he's just sending them nowhere. He's actually sending them literally to the city of Timbuktu, which is in Mali.
A real place.
Yes, or thereabouts anyhow. So why are we sending planes to Mali? Well, there are many reasons. Not many of them good reasons, but there are lots of reasons. First, there is an unlikely link. Canada, thanks to Quebec, is a member of the French version of the Commonwealth. As such, when one French community, Mali, is suffering, there is an appeal by the mother country, France, for the children of the Francophones to come together for mutual aid. So France asked Canada and other nations for help. We sent one transfer plane. If it had ended there, probably not a biggie. But according to recent reports from the CBC, we are sending a second plane. And more importantly, Canadian Special Forces are apparently on the ground to, quote, secure Canadian interests. Not that I know of any Canadian interest in Mali, but hey. Okay, so if we're going to be drawn into a military conflict, I thought, well, maybe it might be important to inform our audience about, well, what's up with Mali? Mali, like many countries in post-colonial Africa, is a pure fiction. No offense to any Africans who think Africa is real, but it is literally lines drawn on the map that have no reflection of the reality on the ground. One of the results of this Euro-imperialism is that Mali has a north and a south. The south, controlled by the Bambara people, who are loyal servants to the French colonials and thus the major power holders in Mali. Now take note, I'm going to use one or two particular ethnic groups. Now this implies that there is a black and white sort of definition of these groups, and quite frankly, these groups don't necessarily see themselves as one people, they see themselves as kind of, sort of like our First Nations, right? But I'm going to use the big broad terms just to simplify for us dumb Canadians.
Fair enough.
The north, never accepting the arbitrary lines of division, sees itself as an independent people and nation. To make things even more complex, many of the ethnic boundaries cross many national boundaries. For example, one of the major pushers for northern Mali independence are the Turgreg people, who, like the Kurds in Armenia, find their people split between nations. In this case, Mali, Algeria, Libya, and Niger. The Tigur, among others, hope to create a sort of a national state that equates to their ethnic state. So, back to Mali. A little background. Last year, the military was becoming more and more upset at the civilian government's handling of this independence movement in the north. The northern parts of Mali have, since the inception of Mali, wanted to become independent. Kind of think of Quebec. Well, the military, most notably the young officer class, were not happy, and last year there was a military coup that toppled their turmoil. This chaos inspired the Tigur, among with other people, and most notably Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, to attempt to... Well, things for this independent movement went quite well. Not only was the Mali army in disarray, but one of the unfortunate side effects of Libyan liberation last year allowed the independence movement to actually succeed. The unfortunate effect I mentioned is that when Gaddafi was overthrown, much of his stockpile of weapons were looted to by whoever had the foresight to say, hey, this could be useful sometime in the future, so they grabbed it. One of these groups was the Al-Qaeda of the Islamic Maghreb. They, at the start, allied with ethnic groups, and in their eyes sort of liberated the north. However, it was not long afterwards in which the Al-Qaeda of the Islamic Maghreb realized that they actually had the big guns. So much of northern Mali fell under their radical fundamentalist Islamic sort of rule. Part of what, you know, they believe in is sort of adhering to a medieval form of Sharia law. This is where the West has heard about, you know, beheading, stoning, amputations of hands and feet and that sort of thing. And this has ostensibly been the impetus for international response to these atrocities. So, according to Western media, the fight against the terrorist Al-Qaeda and the atrocities they have committed, and that's why we're there. And that is true to a point, but little in life is simple. Now, personally, I think the crimes against humanity the Islamists have done warrant their own expungement. Crimes, you might ask? Well, as part of their purification of the land, is also the destruction of monuments and documents that date back 1,000 years or more. This is the property of not a nation, but of the human race. Their destruction is not only a desecration, but a crime against humanity that, in my humble opinion, is greater than really any loss of mere life. No offense to the people who die. But then again, I'm a bit more passionate than the average person on this regards. So, I'm all for the removal of the extremists. But that said, it's not that simple. France, Canada, et al. Are not technically supporting the democratic Mali government, but the coup. In fact, we should first, if we are doing this for noble reasons, restore the elected government, then remove the northern radicals. Why would be? I mean, non-Malis care? Well, it turns out that northern Mali is a uranium-rich area. Many have implied, not necessarily incorrectly, that one of the reasons for such prompt response to Mali is not the social risk, but the economic risk. Although I again think that the religious nuts should be removed from Mali, I am less sure that the north should be returned to southern control. The Tigers and others have a valid... point of self-determination, and it seems that one of the things that are maintaining the status quo is, again, colonial interests in the resources of Africa for their own particular benefit. Any thoughts, Ethan?
Well, I mean, as you say, it is an incredibly complicated issue, difficult to sum up in a few minutes.
I did a good job.
But yeah, an admirable attempt, yes. So getting to the crux of the issue, first maybe with the uranium, you know... Uranium is sort of one of those politically charged buzzwords. And we hear that word and alarm bells go off on our head. And if you hear the words Al-Qaeda and uranium in the same sentence, you usually know it's about to be followed up by strategic bombing effort or something.
Actually, that's one very interesting thing I have not heard. Because outside of a few people who are sort of against Western involvement anywhere, they've mentioned that there's these huge uranium deposits. But you would have thought that, you know, the Americans at least would say, hey, we got to get in there because the terrorists are going to get uranium and that's the end of it. But the Western powers have not mentioned this really at all.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting. You think that would be a primary focus for our attention. One of the complicated issues with, especially with French colonial holdings, they've often had a very kind of different relationship with the former colonies than, say, the British did with their former colonies. And it's hard for Canada, which is primarily a British holdover to relate. And the idea that we're in there for a Quebec connection is also kind of ludicrous, because Quebec has always been a very isolationist, I guess you could call it, demographic in Canada. They were against Canada entering the world wars, and despite the fact that, you know, France was also heavily involved in those wars. So, I mean, it's kind of a tenuous connection at best. And, I mean, France in and of itself, I mean, we can go on and on about France's sort of political history with Islam as well. So it's one of those issues where complications and nuance have created something where it's like, I think very educated, reasonable people will have a nightmare trying to decipher the correct code of response for this type of thing.
Well, you know, it also becomes a lot more complicated because things interact with other things. Now, many of our listeners have probably heard about the hostage taking and taking over of a gas plant in Algeria.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ostensive reasons for that was that because France and other nations were intervening in retaking northern Mali, they were doing this, A, to extort some money so they can help finance the war, but two, as punishment to Algeria for allowing French planes to go to Mali. And, you know, it's like, so which came first, the chicken or the egg sort of thing, right?
Well, yeah, there's always been a bad taste in Algeria's mouth since, you know, France tried to conquer them.
Yeah, but
three or four times.
Here they are sort of acting as allies. And again, the sort of double standard that you have is quite intriguing. The Japanese, to a degree, the British very much so, were horrified when the Algerians came in and they physically retook over the thing. They shot up everyone sort of thing. And they did. They killed all the insurgents, except for, I think, three of them. But they also killed like 20 or 30 of the 130 hostages, right? And, you know, it's going, oh my God, that was horrible. And the Algerians are saying, well, we got them. What are you upset about? And you know, we say, yeah, well, that was horrible that innocents died. But when you take this to something like Yemen or Pakistan, where, yes, we got the bad guys, but we accidentally killed a whole bunch of extra people, it's like, oh yeah, well, that's collateral damage or fog of war sort of thing. But it's one of the jokes, and not jokes, one of the terms that was always sort of offensive in a way is, you know, when you read the news, right, one Canadian makes the headline if he dies. Mm-hmm. But you need about 10,000 East Indians and maybe about 20,000 Chinese before it becomes newsworthy in the West. And I'm going, that somehow just doesn't seem right.
Well, I mean, and the other thing, too, is just war. I guess you could hesitate to call this war. But any kind of military conflict is probably like, it's like using a sledgehammer to, you know, build a fence. It's a messy tool where political and diplomatic, you know, surgery is needed. But of course, if, you know, we were running the world, this wouldn't happen. So
true. Yeah. And it's one of those things, you know, often humanitarian causes are given, but underlying there are geopolitical, economic things. But I guess we'll talk more about that when we come back from a break.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Freethinker.
Hello, this is Rebecca Watson, creator of Skeptic and co-host of the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
To make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
$1 billion on the ground, all stretched out and uncurled, would extend about four times around the circumference of the world.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the West End at
Australian Boot Company, Banyan Books and Sound, Baru Latino Restaurante, The Bike Kitchen, Cove, Dentry's Pub, Displaced Hatchery, Limelight, The Eatery, Fresh is Best Salsa, Gargoyles, Prussian Music, Rufus's Guitar Shop, and the UBC Bookstore.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or online at citr.ca.
And we're back. So Ethan, you know, this has nothing related to what we're going to do before, but let me relate to you one of the most scariest things that ever happened to me in my life. When I was, I don't know, maybe it was about 8 or 10 years old, I went into the movies and I watched this show called Mystery of Bigfoot. And we're talking, this is the 70s when people actually thought really it might exist sort of thing. And one of the things that has haunted me, even to this day thinking about it, gives me shudders, is in the movies, in the movie they had the Bigfoot doing this, this big howl. And it was such a grab your backbone and make it shiver. It was to this day, like I say, the thought of it just makes me quiver. And it was very, very, very scary. But fortunately, that was just the movie. And it's all past me now. I don't have to worry about that anymore. Because, I mean, such a traumatic event, especially happening in one's childhood, I would hate for anything to revisit that horror for me.
You might want to leave the studio for the next 15 minutes. So, as Don alluded to there, we're going to check in with the Bigfoot hunters to see what new and exciting evidence they've uncovered. And this time, it's actually kind of interesting. It is loud shrieking noises, supposedly made by the Bigfoot. So I'm going to play some audio for you here. Don, you can cover your ears. And this is supposedly what a Bigfoot's shrieks or howls sounds like. So take a listen to this. Okay, so there you have it. Totally Bigfoot.
No, I'm okay. I'm okay.
Yeah, okay. So these late night shrieks, which began in November and emanate from a brushy swamp on the Umatilla Indian Reservation, which is east of Pendleton in, I believe, Oregon. It's close to the Oregon Blue Mountains. Huh, sounds like Middle Earth. So anyway, no one has pinpointed the exact source of this noise, but it is a huge area. We're talking about 178,000-acre reservation that extends into the mountains and is home to about 1,500 people. So, of course, you know, the skeptics who have to spoil the party have pointed out that this could include things like foxes or coyotes, which, unlike Bigfoot, are known to exist in the area. Now, one of the confounding factors with animal noises is it's not simply a matter of matching the noise to an animal, but there's also factors that can impact how that noise is heard, including temperature, wind, and geographical features such as canyons.
I did notice in that recording that the rest of it sounded kind of distorted, but
well, it was actually recorded with a phone. So somebody, I guess, sat out in the wilderness and pressed play, sort of like a Blair Witch Project style thing. According to Good Morning America's John Mueller, this latest recording is not the only one. In fact, the mysterious sounds have been coming out of the area since November, and this raises a pretty obvious question. If anyone seriously believes that these sounds are real evidence for Bigfoot, why haven't investigators been able to photograph or videotape the source of the sounds? For example, there is the Finding Bigfoot TV show that has spent months in the area and has so far come up empty-handed. You know, you'd think that a well-financed cable television show would be able to have the equipment needed. So, and in fact, they don't even need really high-tech equipment. It's not rocket science. This is the science of acoustics. So with an array of microphones placed in strategic locations, it'd be really relatively simple to triangulate the location of the sound to within a few feet. And then if you could scan the area with high-resolution cameras or infrared at night, it'd be fairly easy to figure out what kind of animal is making this sound.
Yeah, but maybe they don't have as big a budget as you think they have. I mean, what do the people who do this Finding Bigfoot say as far as their access to equipment?
According to the Finding Bigfoot crew, they have, quote, every bit of cutting-edge technology, night vision gear, and all the sensors they can get their hands on.
Oh, so...
Yeah. So basically, my contention would be that this is not evidence of Bigfoot. In fact, it's not the first time that Bigfoot shrieks have been presented. One company called Sierra Sounds has a CD called The Bigfoot Recordings, The Edge of Discovery, narrated by Star Trek actor Jonathan Frakes. The recording claims to have captured vocalizations among a Bigfoot family. The sounds include a series of guttural grunts, howls, and growls, and the testimonials from a, quote, linguist, whose self-described credentials include playing the flute, speaking several languages, and having a Russian friend who thinks I'm Russian, which is...
You think that you're Russian or thinks that he's Russian?
He's Russian.
Oh, okay.
Because he's so good at linguists, I get, yeah. So anyway, I want to play the howl again, but I'm also going to play after that some fox calls. So take a listen once again to the Bigfoot howl. Okay, Bigfoot howl. Now, let's go to some fox calls. And no, that's not a euphemism for anything.
Yeah, it's usually referred to as wolf whistles, not fox calls. But
I think fox calls is actually a better term. Anyway, fox calls. Listen closely.
Well, obviously, those weren't the same thing, because, I mean, the second one was a lot quieter.
Yeah.
Right. And, yeah. I mean, they didn't have the same sort of interference and noise in the background.
Yeah. Well, I don't think the foxes were using their iPhones. But, okay, so I'm not suggesting that the Bigfoot howls were fox calls, but that doesn't sound like a typical fox. You know, that is obviously recorded somewhere in the distance. The foxes are making that sound. It's reverberating around the environment. It gives you an idea of how a normal-sounding animal can sound really weird.
Yeah, no, and you know, this is one of the things that I've been labeling in my head, the Sherlock Holmes fallacy, is you set down a number of possibilities. So it could have been a fox, could have been a bear, it could have been Bigfoot. When you ruled out whatever isn't true, whatever's left, however improbable, must be true. So no, it's not foxes. No, it's not bears. Therefore, it must be Bigfoot. Well, no, it doesn't have to be Bigfoot. It could have been aliens, if you want to go that round. It could have been a wayward whale that was grounded on the beach of some lake somewhere. I mean, just because you've ruled out what's possible doesn't mean the impossible is necessarily true.
Well, the other thing, too, is, I mean, this could easily be Bigfoot hunters out there hoaxing or something. Like, there's so many possibilities here, and to jump to the conclusion that it's Bigfoot is pretty ludicrous. And again, like, you know, if you've ever been out in the country somewhere and heard, you know, a cat or something, you would swear that you're listening to aliens because they sound pretty weird.
Yeah.
And it just goes to show you that most animals can make a wide variety of sounds that would sound pretty creepy if you assume it's coming from a Bigfoot.
Well, and I have it on good authority that there's an elephant in Korea that speaks Korean. So, I mean...
Yeah, well, there you go.
You know, how much weirder can it get?
Absolutely. Let's go to a quick commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
In the sky, standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
I can feel it all the way down in my plums, getting all swollen, with a light blue hue to them, fresh and juicy, ready for the picking. I want to bite into that plum and let the juice spill down my chin. You know what I mean?
CITR Campus Radio. Can you feel it?
I can feel it down in my plums. They're getting a nice bluish hue. Getting ready to take them to the farmer's market. Special two plums for one.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Don, I understand.
Yes. Okay, so Ethan doesn't like this story. He doesn't want me to bring it up. I think it's a cool story. And, I mean, it's one of those, like, from the Tales from the Far Side, or just, you know, Twilight Zone sort of thing. So, it can be hard as a Canadian to find sources of pride, especially in technology. I mean, we've had the decline of Nortel, RIM is circling the toilet, and that sort of thing. I mean, we do have, the Canadarm, but Canada's not really, known as the number one leader in robotics. So, I was pleasantly surprised, and to be fair, incredibly disgusted, when I discovered that Canada has produced a technological first. Well, a medical first as well. What is this technological marvel, you may be wondering? It's the world's first artificial poop. Yes, you heard it here. Feces, shit, turds. We made it, and we made it better than anyone else. Some scientist in Guelph created what you can only call an artificial intestine, although they call it the repopulator. There's Canada's famous sense of humor coming through again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you may ask why you would want to make artificial poop. There seems to be more than enough of it to go around. In fact, it's when poop gets in the wrong places, like in your food, that people can get very, very sick. When this happens, we often prescribe antibiotics. A nasty side effect of some antibiotics is the destruction of the stomach's biome. It basically kills all the bacteria that you have in your stomach. When this happens, a hostile takeover can occur. Often bad bacteria, such as C. difficile, can come in and cause tremendous hardship, suffering, and even death. In the past, one way to treat this hostile takeover was to repopulate the stomach with the patient's old biome. Of course, the only way to do this was to collect a sample from the patient, or more unsettling, a sample from a close relative or a roommate. Because apparently, if you live with someone, your biomes kind of adjust to each other.
Hmm.
Now, collecting a sample of poop, turning it into a shake, and then sterilizing the stomach, re-ingesting, and they're repopulating. So yes, it's a poop shake.
Hmm.
Now, the problem with this method, besides, of course, the aftertaste, is doctors were never quite sure what bacteria they were introducing, because again, it was sort of a wild environment. Enter the repopulate, the world's first artificial poop. Because it's made under controlled conditions, it's possible to ensure the quality, the variety, and the quantity of the replacement biome. So essentially, you have a lot more control, and you can ensure that you will have a healthy repopulation of the forest that is your stomach. Of course, another advantage I heard is that you get a much better selection of flavors, raspberry, apple, that sort of thing.
That's gross.
Much better than natural. There, it's over, Ethan.
Yay. Okay, well, thank you for that disgusting piece of science news, Tom.
Okay, so let's move on to our big topic of the day, the real cost of casinos. Recently, the Surrey City Council voted to not allow the expansion of gambling in that city by rejecting a plan to build a new casino in the city. There was much contention leading up to the vote, with reports of city councillors receiving intimidating phone calls from provincial ministers and the head of the BC Lotteries Commission, leading to accusations of ethic violation and inappropriate behavior. We're going to sidestep most of the political machinations surrounding this decision itself by focusing on the controversy. Is gambling a net pro or con for the community? Did you know that almost all gambling in Canada was illegal until the 70s? Horse racing and summer fair bets, things like ring toss and that, were allowed thanks to English common law. But until the 70s, gambling as we know it, lotteries and the like, were illegal. And even then, it was sort of intended to be small scale, community bingos, or limited scope, the lottery, one lottery. However, you may not know, but gambling was a big business around the world, especially south of the border. Did you know that, Ethan?
I've heard of this, yes.
So business wanted to expand, so Canada's rules have been loosening up. We got our first casino in 1989, and many more have followed, with both the mafia, legitimate business interests, and government making lots of money on the desperate. First, there are many types of gambling. There's the informal type that, hey, Ethan, I'll bet you $10 that the NDP win the next provincial election, where, two private people have a bet. Now, beyond the fact that this is almost impossible to police, we're also going to essentially ignore it. There is online gambling. Now, this is best known in the proliferation of online poker sites. Although there is legislation to regulate this type of gambling, due to the global nature of the internet, this is another area that is, beyond some token efforts, almost impossible to enforce. So again, we're going to kind of ignore it. The type of gambling we're going to discuss falls into three broad categories: casinos, electronic gambling machines, think slot machines, and of course, lotteries, lottos. One aspect of legalized gambling mentioned is the boost you get to tourism it provides. Now, This seems not applicable to electronic gambling or nor to lotteries, but there can be a case made for casinos. One only has to look at Las Vegas to see the potential tourism boom gambling can have. But the lower mainland, Las Vegas North, local casinos generate about $72 million in income to the BC Lottery Commissions. And now the now failed proposal to Surrey promised to generate $130 million in construction business and then an annual input of about $23 million in non-gambling income, you know, hotel sales, food sales, that sort of thing, and another $74 million in gambling income, of which $4 million would go to the city of Surrey, and it was supposed to create something like 800 plus jobs, a payroll of $15 million, and create, again, a visitor base of about 900,000 gamblers. Sounds good, if a bit optimistic. But although not a zero-sum game, there will be some negative impacts to the local economy, as well as, you know, things like the other hotels that are going to lose, the other eateries. One of the main features of a casino is once you get the person in the building, you don't want them to leave until they have no money. Now, any investment over $100 million will, of course, have some positive impacts on the economy, and in and of itself. But to say that it's a good investment to the city is another way, it's not the right question. Essentially, you have to say, is it a good investment compared to what? So if you're going to spend that $100 million on anything, is this the best thing to be spending on? In my research, I found that there are many other, quote, tourist attractions that could provide a greater draw. A study done in Toronto showed that cultural events, like concerts, that sort of thing, brought in 85 times more money than a casino would. Museums and art gallery, the Nerdfest, they bring in twice as much. Even something like the PNE, which we have here, is like 50% more effective at bringing in tourist dollars to the city.
Well, the question I have with that is, like, what kind of casino are they comparing it to? Because, I mean, I would think that, like a Caesar's Palace would bring in more tourists than, say, you know, like a kind of a casino off the highway, right, type thing.
So this was sort of done as in Toronto, which is where the study was, is, okay, 2008. How much money was generated from tourism, from cultural events? How much money was generated from, and how much was generated from the casinos that already exist in the city itself? So it was that kind of a cost balance analysis.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not perfect, but gives you some idea.
Yeah, that definitely gives you, I mean, if we're going to compare a normal city, Las Vegas is not really a normal city, I don't think, and terms of its gambling.
No.
But if you're going to compare like a typically average city and gambling, it seems like a pretty good comparison.
Yeah. Now, one could point out that the government make lots of money off of gambling. As stated, the casinos pump $75 million into community budgets and about 10 times that much into provincial coffers. Now, the numbers I'm using are from the BC Lottery Commission's 2012 report. To be fair, some of the numbers didn't quite add up to me. Their accounting seemed a bit weird. Not dodgy, just weird. For example, the Liquor Commission's revenue from casinos was stated to be $1.3 billion. But overall amounts of income from casinos and community groups, so combining two things together, think bingo and the casino, was less than $900 million. So I'm not quite sure where all the numbers come from, but $900 million seems to be more realistic from the revenue they got from the casinos than that went straight into spending for the province.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the point being, regardless of how you sort of parse these numbers, casinos are profit centers, the proverbial cash cow. But there is a twist. In another study I found, it seems that not all gambling forms get along. As it turns out, casinos and horse races do well together. This explains Fraser Downs, which is a successful racino, which combines the two. Racino is a term that one of my researchers came across, that racehorse and casino, racino.
Mm. Yeah.
Thank you for the help.
Yes.
However, casinos do not seem to get along with lotteries. Studies have shown that the net effect, that the money earned by casinos and that earned by lottos, that there's a net loss in the gambling revenues from the state. In fact, the study showed that casinos net a reduction of 7 cents on gambling dollars and surprisingly 30 cents on the dollar of reduction for lotto revenues. So again, when you have a casino and you have a lottery in the same sort of market, both of them make less money because they somehow, I'm not sure exactly what the effect would be, but people tend to spend less money and you tend to make less money out of it.
Well, probably people go, instead of buying my lotto ticket this week, I'll go to the casino, or vice versa. Instead of going to the casino, I'll buy an extra lotto ticket.
And you have the thing that, you know, lotteries to a certain extent have some fixed costs, as in we have to pay out like $1 million every week sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And casinos are, you know, we can increase or decrease our staffing. There's a lot more control over it. The point being is that casinos, as far as lotto revenue go, they don't go very well together. And you get the similar effect with casinos. Although, again, ironically enough, horse racing, dog racing, people seem to love doing both of those. Okay, so the economics are dubious at best. But the biggest issue that arose in Surrey wasn't the economic ones, but the social cost. It was worried that Surrey would become Las Vegas North, and that this would lead to an increase in crime and other social ills.
Were they serious when they said that, or were they laughing?
Which, Las Vegas North?
Yeah.
No, I made up that term.
Okay. Because that'd be really funny if someone said that Surrey was going to be Las Vegas North.
Yeah. No, but I mean, the mentality was there. It's like, you know, we don't want to be known as, you know, a gambling center, because if it is, that's going to be a draw for all these other negatives.
Right? As opposed to the other negatives that Surrey is known for.
I'm not from the Lower Mainland. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay.
Okay, so going back. Now, to be fair, with regards to petty crime, muggings and the like, studies are a bit mixed. It does seem to rely actually more on how and where the casinos are placed as to how they aggravate local crime. So gambling centers that are sort of purpose-built and away from urban centers, there's a low impact on that kind of petty crime. Whereas when they're placed sort of in the heart of downtown, the impact can be actually quite significant. So ironically enough, the gambling centers that are in downtown Vancouver are actually much more at risk of petty crime increase than this particular proposal that they were going to have in Surrey, which was actually kind of out of the way sort of thing. That said, there are other forms of crime that consistently follow casinos. Money laundering. This was a major issue last year. Well, let's be fair, it's occurred almost every year. Anyway, last year, when major money laundering operations were uncovered at local casinos. Now, I should point out, it's not by the casinos. This isn't a Ronin or Ocean's 11 sort of operation. It's where organized crimes go in and they buy chips and then they collect prize winnings. And in doing so, they have essentially legalized their ill-gotten gains. Now, the real social harm that arises in gambling is its addiction. One consistent with regards to the introduction of gambling casinos is the rapid rise of gaming addiction. These are people who will not only ruin their own lives, but they bring down the lives of their friends and their families. I don't think gambling addiction are special or different than drug addictions, with the possible exception of medical risks. And even that said, a number of gambling addicts have been known to turn to drug dealing and prostitution to feed their gambling habit. Now, at the start, we said we would address three types of gambling, and so far, we've only really focused on casinos. Well, so far, my attack. And yes, I think I am against casinos. Basically, I've been only talking about the economic aspects of it. These seem to have been mostly the most politically broad appeal. But at the start, again, mentioning the three types, you know, casinos, electronic gambling, which are similar to casinos, but their economic arguments are a bit stronger. And, of course, lotteries, which have been proven by almost every economic measure to be a winner. I confess, I've only actually myself been to a casino twice, and I've only electronically gambled once. But I used to play the lotto quite consistently at one point, so fair dinkum there.
Hmm.
Well, libertarians, neoliberal, Harper conservatives, they think the only issue is economics. But there are, well, economists call externalities, there are these things called externalities, which are external costs to gambling. That is, cost not explicitly paid by, for example, the casino. This is the social cost of gambling, the cost not paid by the BC Lottery Commission or casino owners, but taken on behalf of the individuals of gambling and, more importantly, the society that must care for the victims of gambling. Now, the social harms to a community due to gambling addiction are uncontroversial. That said, does the concept of harm reduction apply here? Ethan, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, I don't know. I mean, like, it seems, at least from my understanding, that you can call up almost any casino anytime and place a bet. So it's not like not having a local casino is not going to generate gambling addiction. I mean, you can become a gambling addict by playing poker with your friends. So
how's that going?
Well, yeah. But the point being, though, I mean, yes, I guess you could say that if you have a casino and people start going, they could develop an addiction. But I don't know. It just sort of seems like you can develop an addiction to phoning up your casino and placing a bet on the horses or whatever.
No, I actually, you know, and this is something I've taken quite a bit of thought about. And I do kind of agree with you. But one of the empirical arguments against it, and again, there's a consistent empirical evidence that shows that when a gambling casino enters a community, and I think that would even extend to something like a bingo hall. I mean, I'm not picking on casinos per se. But when there's sort of a physical presence that's sort of in your face, it becomes a much greater temptation. And you couple that, and it's not so bad now, but about a year or so ago where I work, it became a social venue. So even if you weren't a gambler, hey, let's all go to the casino, we're going to have some drinks, we're going to do a little dancing, we'll play a few card games. And so the opportunities to get your first hit seem to increase. You're right, gambling is ubiquitous, it's online all the time. But that actually scares off a lot of people, because if you go online, you got to use your Visa card or something online, and that's a huge deterrent to a lot of people.
Right.
In casinos, you don't have that. Lotteries, well, again, you know, you can go in and you can lay down like a $20 and buy your lottery ticket. But when you go to a casino, you're not laying down a $20. That's just the first hand, and then you pay the second hand, the third hand. So it's the way addiction works, especially gambling addiction, is you need that sort of irregular but consistent rush of winning. And lottos are just too slow to supply that. But casinos do that perfectly. In fact, they're custom designed to do that. I think actually the one-armed bandits, the electronic gambling in the sense of slot machines, is probably even worse at that. And so casinos would be number one on my list, or maybe number two, and the one-armed bandits would be number one to get rid of.
Interesting.
Well, okay, so we've had a few good points there. Now, with regards to the cost, one study I read estimated that to the individual, there was a cost of about $20,000 a year in maintaining their addiction. And that was not including the actual money they spent on gambling, but the cost of lost work hours, counseling, legal costs, bankruptcies, etc. And that's not even including the social costs like divorce, childhood trauma, deterioration of communities. Now, to be fair, this was one study that did a very thorough but localized review of that. So these numbers are more as an example, as opposed to this is hard, cold fact, but just to put something out there so we get an idea of the context. The Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives points out that gambling is actually just another form of regressive taxation. Why, you might say? Well, it tends to be those in the lowest economic strata who buy lottery tickets or take their chances at the cards. People who gamble in a desperate attempt to escape the crushing poverty that is ever-increasing part of our socially unequal society. There are also a number of studies that point out that the biggest pushers of gambling are not big corporations that build the mega casinos, but governments themselves that see gambling as a way to increase provincial revenues without having to use those dirty words, raising taxes. Although for the bottom 50% is effectively a tax, because again, you might call it a voluntary donation, but people who are desperate to escape poverty of their daily lives, I mean, is it really voluntary? I mean, if you had any chance to get out? And if you want to be frank, what does it say about a society that sort of accepts this parasitism of an addicted class to offset social needs and costs for the rest of us? Okay, so my position, you know, on state-sponsored gambling should be pretty clear by now. Most of it is based, I think, on good science. Some of it is, of course, social opinion. Do you have any thoughts with regards to government's addiction to gambling?
Well, again, I don't know if I would call it an addiction, because, I mean, if you look at a lot of municipalities have taken a very sort of prohibitionist stance on gambling. I mean, it's some communities view it as kind of like this sort of moral evil that once infiltrating the society will sort of poison it from within. And then you have places, you know, like the Las Vegas and the Atlantic cities of the world that sort of embrace it. And, you know, it is kind of hard to take. Like, if you were to take a place like Atlantic City, because again, I think Vegas is sort of a one-off, and compare it to a comparable city that doesn't have legal gambling, and compare it in terms of poverty and crime and bad stuff, would you see a noticeable difference? I don't know if you would see a huge noticeable difference, because I think that vices that are motivated by sort of poor economic standing or class standing, you usually just find another release. It's not like, you know, someone's like, oh, my life sucks, I'm going to go gamble. If there was no casino, they'd be like, oh, okay, I'll just, you know, sit here then. They're probably going to go find something else to do that's equally as bad for them.
Again, that's an interesting thing. But what about the aspect of governments? I mean, one of the things, and now I'm going off the top of my head, so my numbers might be off, but the context is, again, pretty sound. The amount of revenue that provincial governments have gotten in from gambling have gone up orders of magnitude since they first kind of got into the business, like since the 90s. You know, the 90s, you might have got a couple of $1 million from gambling. Now we're getting a couple $1 billion from gambling. And that there's this sort of, how do I put it? It's easy in the one sense for the BC Lottery Commission to throw on three new lotteries in order to rake in an extra, you know, couple $1 million than it is for the BC Liberals to sit there and say, well, we're going to put an extra 0.01% increase on income tax on XY group. Yeah. So that in a way it becomes, not only do you have the addiction, however you get it, you know, so the source is irrelevant, but you're actually, again, there's this sort of parasitism that's going on with it. And how as a society do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, governments need money too. But the thing is, like, I mean, how do you police that? Like, you can't really fault a government for trying to get more resources because, again, taxes pay for things. If we had a government that got no taxes, then we're not going to have anything.
That seems a bit black and white. So I suspect that I hadn't said that we shouldn't collect any taxes. I'm just saying that in a certain way, this is taking a vulnerable segment of the community and using their addiction in order to profit from it. And I mean, I mean, again, I wouldn't blame the casinos for doing this. I mean, it's still morally reprehensive, but I mean, their goal isn't to make money. Their goal, I mean, sorry.
Their goal is to make money.
Their goal is to make money, but the government's goal isn't to make money. The government is to create the best possible society you can have. Mm. And above and beyond the fact that you're allowing this sort of underclass to exist, which we already discussed is a bit more complicated, but you're actually actively feeding off it, and not a little bit. So it's kind of akin to sin taxes, I guess, in a certain way, right? I mean, one of the things that we've sort of advocated on the show is the idea of legalizing and bringing it out in the open a number of illegal drugs, right? Not all of them, but some of them. Mm-hmm. And that you can actually tax this and have this as a source of revenue. But at the same time, what would strike us as odd is if the government was trying to get everyone to take heroin and then upping the taxes on the heroin so as they can forestall a tax increase on everyone.
Well, I mean, you can look at it in two aspects, though. You can look at it in the sense that regulation is better than no regulation. And you can look at it in the sense that if we're looking at it from a harm reduction point of view, you'd almost want to say that a gambling should be legal and that it should have really high tax or it should be sort of like a tax because that's dissuade people from gambling as much if there was sort of like a high markup on it.
Or maybe if there's an entrance fee to get into casinos.
Yeah.
But then that would help hurt their business model.
Well, I mean, again, though, I don't have anything really against hurting the business model of casinos.
Okay. Well, okay. So we've, like I say, we've talked many times about the idea of harm reduction, right? So, one could assume, imperfectly, I think, but credibly, that gambling addicts, as you say, would give into temptation sooner or later. So as a society, again, maybe we're looking at this the wrong way. Maybe we should look at the casinos as sort of like insight, you know, and drug addiction. That these sort of provide a safe place where they can exercise their addiction, but have easy access to gambling rehab. So I'm sort of flipping, taking your point of view there, Ethan.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you noticed that.
I did notice that. It's very good.
One of the things I found very interesting while reading the BC Lottery Commission's annual report and their website was the amount of time and space they devote to, quote, helping gambling addicts. Now, the sort of blatant, over-the-top, pro-gambling attitude that the Crown Corporation takes does make me kind of doubt the honesty of their intentions in this regard. But the point still remains is that one of the overt purposes of casinos and gambling centers is also to provide a conduit for addicts to get treatment. Well, I mean, that's a good thing, no? So I don't know if I'm being inconsistent, and the research, I think, does back me up a bit more than perhaps others in this room's opinions have. But in this case, I think, you know, a ban on organized gambling would be a good thing, but that in the end, it would make society safer. But obviously, you don't agree with me on that, Ethan.
I don't think so. I think that an outright ban would just be like, say, here, Mafia, run our gambling establishment for us. You know, like... If history has taught us one thing, that as soon as you try to ban something, the people who use that service will just go, oh, so it's not regulated anymore. And they'll turn to other avenues to get it. It's like banning alcohol or banning...
slavery.
Well, maybe. But banning drugs, I mean, we that has not really worked out for us very well. And I think the thing with gambling is you want to ask yourself, like, you know... What is a safer institution, having the mob run a casino or having government oversight run a casino?
Well, but don't we in a way have both? I mean, because these are not government casinos; they're licensed.
Well,
by the
government, yeah,
but they are run by the by legitimate business interests.
Well, they're not. It's hard to prove whether or not they're being run by, you know, the mafia, as in, you know, Tony Soprano. Type thing.
Well, we will be able to test that out. My car blows up on the way out, and we'll know.
Well, actually, I mean, I have actually heard it said, and sort of in a kind of silly context, that since Vegas kind of cleaned up its act, and the casinos were taken over by sort of conglomerates and, you know, movie studios and that sort of thing, that it lost the charm that it used to have when the mafia ran things. And I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Casino. There's a scene at the end where Robert De Niro's character is sort of talking about how Vegas has changed, and he calls it Disneyland. You know, like you see families out and about. You don't see people in tuxedos and classy clothes, and you can forget about getting room service within 20 minutes of ordering and that kind of thing. So, I mean, there is an element to taking away a legitimate vice from people who are sort of ruthless in their execution of that vice to people who just want to profit legally with, you know, some political machinations, right? So, I mean, it's very hard to stamp out, weed out gambling. I don't think we'll ever be able to do that kind of thing.
See, and this is where I, you know, I have to do a bit of soul searching, maybe where we can sort of end with our thoughts on this, is that, I mean, I've been a vocal and active proponent of, you know, legalization of drugs, the bringing them out into the open so that you can deal with it, and in that way sort of diminish their actual harm to society. And yet, somehow, when I apply that same argument to gambling, it doesn't strike me to be as cogent. Somehow, I think gambling addiction is not the same as drug addiction, but I admit that's an inconsistency in my own thinking. But the evidence?
Well, I mean, we all know that we are emotional creatures and that our emotions will tint how we see certain things. And, you know, for some people, the idea of legalizing drugs is... anthema, and for some people, tolerating government-regulated, sanctioned gambling is going to be really difficult to take. So,
really, do you think that? Do you want to bet?
How much?
Okay, so I guess on that note, we'll go to our skeptic highlights.
Yes.
I have three this week.
Alrighty then.
My first one is a bit of a repeat, but it's coming up. Arab Awakening, but are we hearing the truth? Veteran Middle East journalist Robert Fisk has seen it all in his 30 years of international journalism. Yet perhaps nothing could compare to the upheaval in the Middle East that began in 2011 with what some have termed the Arab Spring. Join Fisk as he talks about his reporting from the epicenter of this tension with his honest and insightful perspective. Actually, I loved it. It was quite a unique take on what we normally get. So this is happening Sunday, February 2nd at 7 p.m. at the Gold Corp Center for the Arts in Vancouver. No gambling allowed. Tickets are $15, $10 for students. Next one, Meme War, The Creative Destruction of Neoclassical Economics. This is a book and talk. Is about the articulation of what could be seen as the next step in rethinking and remaking our world that challenges and debunks many of the assumptions of neoclassical economics and brings to light the more ecological model. Meme Wars aims at accelerating the shift into this new paradigm that is to take us into different accounts of psychoeconomics, bioeconomics, and other aspects of our physical and mental environment that are often left undiscussed in economics. So you can join founder and senior editor of Adbusters, Kella Lassen, and Darren Fleet at this public event and book launch. This is happening next Tuesday at 7 p.m. at the Norm Theater right here at the Sub at UBC Vancouver. The cost is free. Now, for all the nerds out there, the CRTC has released a draft version of its wireless code. The CRTC launched the second phase of its public consultation by unveiling a draft code of wireless services. According to the CRTC, Canadians have made a number of proposals for the wireless code, including some that they should take a hold of. For example, a clear understanding of their wireless services and fees. Quite often there are hidden fees and that sort of thing. The ability to unlock your phones with reasonable terms, the ability to set caps on additional fees and those, you know, get out of my contract fees, among other things. So they've come up with a draft and now they want your opinion on it. So go to consultation.crtc.gc.ca and let your voice be heard. Of course, the link will be on our website. Ethan, do you have anything exciting to tell our people?
I do, actually. So a couple of things I want to point your attention to. The first one is a Philosopher's Cafe. This is happening on February 20th at 7 p.m. And the discussion is with John Atkin, a well-known civic historian. And the topic is, why do we worry about heritage? Which I think is kind of a relevant topic, especially here in Vancouver the last little while. So, you know, why are we interested in architecture, history, and neighborhoods? And, you know, why do we care about old-fashioned buildings and that kind of thing? What does this have an impact on our community? So this Philosopher's Cafe will be discussing these very topics. So I encourage you to check them out. And once again, Wednesday, the 20th of February, 7 p.m. at the Secular Jewish Museum, which is located at 6184 Ash Street. And always a good time. The other skeptical highlight I'd like to point your attention to is perhaps an opportunity for you to attend one of two very interesting skeptical conferences. One of them is the Women in Secularism Conference. It's happening in Washington, D.C. And the other is the Atheist Alliance International Conference. It's also happening later this year. So the good folks at Skeptic are offering two scholarships. So if you're a man who would like to go to the Women in Secularism Conference, you can register for a scholarship to attend that conference. And if you're a woman who wants to go to the Atheist Alliance Conference, you can also receive a scholarship. So if you're interested in either of those two conferences, it's a good opportunity to go and, you know, learn something.
No, you're not getting off that easy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the Skeptichicks, which are the female blog group
yeah,
of the internet, you know, most outspoken and, you know, rightly so. They are wanting to send men to the women's conference, and they're not sending women.
They want to send a man to the Women in Secularism Conference because...
Lynching?
What's that?
They're going to lynch him? They need someone to put on the...
Well, no, Don. Feminists are not actually that violent. The purpose is last year, the Women in Secularism Conference was a big success. A lot of women attended, but very few men did. And ideally, the people who we want to attend a conference talking about a woman's role in secularism would be, you know, some men to go and like, oh, maybe I can learn a thing or two. So that's why they want to send a gentleman to the Women in Secularism Conference.
This is exactly why feminism and secularism does not get along. I mean, they want to have a reasonable, understanding dialogue between people. They want understanding. They want, you know, exchange of information. That's not how these things go. Actually, no. Full kudos. Yes.
Kudos.
That's actually quite a good thing.
Yeah, so check. You can find it easily on skeptic.org, so I encourage you to look that up.
And there'll be a link on our website. Please drop by our website. And for the number of people who have given me comments about blog posts and that we've made via Facebook, please feel free to make those very same comments on our website underneath the post. Share your views with more than just me. I appreciate to hear your feedback, but share it with the rest of the universe. They want to hear the insightful and witty things you have to say.
Yes, witty things. Well, let's wrap up for today. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian, thanking you for listening to Radio Freethinker.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com. And subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. A cosmos.